Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day to help you learn and improve your American English skills. Today, we go back into the classroom for an English lesson about verb tenses. Do you know what that means? They tell us how an action relates to time. There are 12 major verb tenses that English learners should know. To learn them, you may need to think about time in a different way. To get us started, here is Jill Robbins.
There are three main verb tenses in English: present, past, and future. The present, past, and future tenses are divided into four aspects: the simple, progressive, perfect, and perfect progressive. There are 12 major verb tenses that English learners should know. English has only two ways of forming a tense from the verb alone, the past and the present. For example, we drove and we drive. To form other verb tenses, you have to add a form of have, be, or will in front of the verb. These are called helping or auxiliary verbs.
Verb tenses can be difficult to learn in a foreign language. Different cultures think different ways about time. Chinese, for example, has no grammatical verb tenses. Other languages, like Indonesian, express time only through adverbs. There are no changes to the verb form. English verb tenses give many details about time and action, such as: is the action finished? How long did the action happen? Was the action repeated? Did the action happen at a known or unknown time? Is the action a habit? Is the action planned or spontaneous? It is difficult to think about time distinctions that do not exist in your own language. So, it can take many years for English learners to master verb tenses. Let's get started. We are going to give examples of all 12 verb tenses using the verb drive.
We'll start with the simple tenses. These are probably the first tenses you learned in English. Simple tenses usually refer to a single action. In general, simple tenses express facts and situations that existed in the past, exist in the present, or will exist in the future. Simple present.
I drive home every day.
Simple past.
I drove home yesterday.
Simple future.
I will drive home later. Let's go on to the progressive tenses. We use progressive tenses to talk about unfinished events. Progressive tenses are also called continuous tenses. Past progressive.
I was driving when you called.
Present progressive.
I am driving now.
Future progressive.
I will be driving when you call. Now let's look at the perfect tenses. Perfect tenses cause the most confusion. To put it simply, they express the idea that one event happens before another event. There are many tricky exceptions with the perfect tenses, which we will discuss in a future episode. The adverbs never, yet, and already are common in perfect tenses. Present perfect.
I have driven that road.
Past perfect.
I had already driven that road in the past.
Future perfect.
I will have driven 200 miles by tomorrow. Finally, let's look at the perfect progressive tenses. Generally, perfect progressive tenses express duration, or how long. Perfect progressive tenses usually include the adverbs for or since. Present perfect progressive.
I have been driving since this morning.
Past perfect progressive.
I had been driving for 3 hours before I stopped to get gas.
Future perfect progressive.
I will have been driving for 5 hours by the time I arrive.
And that's the 12 major verb tenses in English. Don't worry if you don't understand everything yet. Here are some recommendations we have for learning verb tenses.
First, think of adverbs as your friends. Adverbs of time offer valuable clues about the correct verb tense. Let's use the adverb ago. Ago is only used in the simple past, as in, I left home 3 years ago. The adverb ago is never used in the present perfect. Certain adverbs occur with certain verb tenses. English learners sometimes try to impress people by using complex verb tenses. You often have a choice of several verb tenses. When you do, always choose the simplest one. It will be clear for your listener, and there is less chance of making a mistake.
Native speakers don't think consciously about verb tenses. With enough practice, English learners can internalize the verb tense system too. Instead of worrying about deep time relationships, try using adverbs and your ear to choose the right verb tense. Often when someone asks a question, you can respond in the same verb tense. We'll ask a question in each verb tense. Give an answer in the same tense, then listen to our answer. Ready? Did you get enough sleep last night?
Yes, I slept well.
Do you shower every day?
Yes, I shower every day.
Are you going to study tonight?
Yes, I'm going to study tonight.
What were you doing when I called you last night?
I was eating dinner when you called me last night.
What are you doing right now?
I am practicing verb tenses right now.
What will you be doing at midnight on New Year's Eve?
I will be celebrating the New Year with my friends. Had you ever tried skiing before today?
Yes, I had already done it several times before.
Have you ever broken the law?
No, I have never broken the law.
Will you have gotten married by the time you turn 30?
No, I will not have gotten married by the time I turn 30.
How long had you been smoking before you quit?
I had been smoking for 2 years before I quit.
How long have you been waiting for the bus?
I have been waiting for the bus for 20 minutes.
How long will you have been working before you retire?
I will have been working for 30 years before I retire.
This is just a basic introduction to verb tenses. In the following weeks, we will cover the more difficult verb tenses in more detail. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Recently, Brazil has seen a rise in birth defects that cause babies to be born with very small heads. The babies suffer from a condition known as microcephaly. Ana Mateo has more on microcephaly and the Zika virus.
Health officials in Brazil have declared a state of emergency in several states. They are also warning women to not get pregnant. These extreme actions are the result of a recent rise in birth defects. About 2,400 babies in Brazil were born recently with extremely small heads. The babies have a condition called microcephaly. Microcephaly causes severe brain damage. To date, 29 of these babies have died. The number of microcephaly cases in Brazil is about 10 times higher than what the country usually sees in a year. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control explains on its website that there are many causes of microcephaly. And the World Health Organization said in a statement that the cause of the microcephaly outbreak in Brazil had yet to be determined. However, the CDC says the link between a virus infection and microcephaly is being investigated. The virus is called Zika. Zika is spread by mosquitoes. Some babies in Brazil with microcephaly have tested positive for the Zika virus, while others have tested negative. The CDC says that Brazil reported its first case of Zika virus in May 2015. Since then, the virus has spread and has caused infections in many Brazilian states and other countries in Latin America. According to other news agencies, health officials have reported many cases of microcephaly in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo. Reuters news agency reports that the Zika virus has been confirmed this year in Panama, Venezuela, El Salvador, Mexico, Suriname, Colombia, Guatemala, and Paraguay. Zika is also found in Africa and Southeast Asia. The CDC has a web page with information on Zika. It says that because the mosquitoes that spread Zika virus are found throughout the world, it is likely that outbreaks will spread to new countries. The CDC says the common symptoms of Zika are fever, rash, headache, joint pain, and red eyes. Zika causes mostly mild symptoms in adults. However, in newborns, the disease can cause severe brain damage. There is no vaccine or medicine to prevent or treat Zika. Travelers, and especially pregnant women, are advised to protect themselves by avoiding mosquito bites. Health officials around the world are watching the situation closely. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the presidential election of 1888, one issue that played a major part was tariffs. At that time, import taxes were high on many products. The high tariffs protected American goods from competing with lower-priced foreign imports. The tariffs protected millions of jobs in American industry. Not everyone, however, supported high tariffs. The President of the United States, Grover Cleveland, decided that high tariffs were wrong. He told other Democratic leaders that he would try to get the tariffs reduced. The politicians warned him not to try. They said he would only lose the support of business people. They said he would need campaign money from business if he expected to be elected president again. But Cleveland rejected their advice. This week in our series, Shirley Griffith and Ray Freeman tell about the presidential election of 1888.
President Cleveland believed that high tariffs hurt more Americans than they protected. High tariffs, he said, led to high prices on all products. He also opposed high tariffs because they brought in more money than the government needed. The extra money was kept in the public treasury, and this, Cleveland believed, slowed the American economy. The president's Democratic Party united to support his policy of lowering tariffs. When the party held its presidential nominating convention in 1888, delegates quickly renominated Cleveland.
At the Republican Party convention, delegates were expected to nominate Senator James Blaine. Blaine had been the party's candidate 4 years earlier. He had lost to Cleveland in a very close election. Senator Blaine publicly criticized the president's policy on tariffs. He said he looked forward to a full debate on the issue. Republicans thought this meant that Blaine wanted to be nominated for president again. They told him he was sure to win. They said it would be such an easy victory that he would not have to campaign.
In fact, Blaine did not want the nomination. He asked that his name not be put before the convention. He met with reporters to talk about his decision. He said, "A man who has once been the candidate of his party and defeated owes it to his party not to be a candidate again." Many Republicans refused to accept Blaine's decision. They felt that if Blaine were nominated, he would run. Blaine replied, "If the presidential nomination is offered to me, I could not and would not accept it." That was final. Blaine's supporters had to find someone else to nominate for president.
Fourteen men declared themselves to be candidates for the Republican nomination. A leading candidate was Senator John Sherman of Ohio. Another was former Senator Benjamin Harrison of Indiana. Convention delegates voted several times. No man received enough votes to win the nomination. Then a message came from James Blaine. It said, "Nominate Harrison." On the eighth vote, the delegates did. Benjamin Harrison was the grandson of the ninth President of the United States, William Henry Harrison. Benjamin was a lawyer. He had been a general in the Union Army during America's Civil War of the 1860s.
After nominating Harrison, the Republicans approved a strong policy statement on the tariff question. The statement said, We fully support the American system of protection. President Cleveland and his party serve the interests of Europe. We would support the interests of America. We would see all other taxes ended before we surrender any part of the protective tariff system.
Benjamin Harrison's campaign was well organized. His campaign workers went to businessmen who had become rich because of high protective tariffs. They asked for support, and the businessmen gave millions of dollars to the campaign. The businessmen also put pressure on the people who worked for them. They warned workers that if Cleveland were reelected, there might be no more jobs. Republican Party leaders took an active part in the campaign of 1888. They made speeches and led parades across the country. The party also printed millions of pamphlets that warned against what it called Cleveland's free trade policies.
Grover Cleveland's campaign was not well organized. It started slowly. It did not raise much money. No effort was made to answer Republican attacks on the tariff issue. And the president himself refused to campaign. He said he had more important things to do. The Democrats also failed to stop the Republicans from buying votes on Election Day. In Indiana, for example, men were paid $15 to vote for the Republican candidate. The Democrats bought votes, too, but they had less money to spend than the Republicans. When the popular votes were counted, Cleveland had about 100,000 more than Harrison. But Harrison had more electoral votes. He won the election.
Grover Cleveland had mixed feelings about his defeat. He wanted to win because he believed his policies were best for the country. He said he was not sorry that he had made tariffs the major issue in the campaign. "I do not regret it," he said. "It is better to be defeated battling for an honest idea than to win by a cowardly trick." When President Cleveland and his wife left the White House, Mrs. Cleveland said goodbye to the servants. She told one of them, "I want you to take good care of all the furniture and other things in the house. I want to find everything the same when we come back 4 years from now."
The new president, Benjamin Harrison, had big political debts to repay. He understood this when he began organizing his administration. "When I came to power," Harrison said, "I found that my party's leaders had taken all the power for themselves. I could not name my own cabinet. They had sold every cabinet position to pay for the election."
The position of Secretary of State went to James Blaine, who had refused his party's requests to run for president. Blaine had served as Secretary of State under Presidents James Garfield and Chester Arthur. The position of Postmaster General went to John Wanamaker. Wanamaker had raised most of the money for Harrison's campaign. He had given $50,000 of his own money. He planned to repay party supporters with jobs in the post office department.
During the campaign, Harrison had promised to enforce the civil service law that protected the job rights of government workers. He promised that workers would be removed only in the interests of better government. Wanamaker and other party leaders criticized Harrison. They said they could not build a strong party organization without promising government jobs to voters. So President Harrison suspended the civil service laws that protected postal workers. Within a year, 30,000 Democrats were removed from the department. Their jobs went to Republicans. The president then announced that the post office would once again be protected by the civil service laws.
Former President Cleveland had been troubled by the extra money in the federal treasury. This was tax money the government collected, but did not use. Most of the extra money came from high protective tariffs on imported products. Cleveland wanted to reduce the surplus by reducing the tariffs. President Harrison decided to reduce the surplus too, but he would do it by increasing government spending, not by cutting taxes. Congress agreed. It became the first Congress to spend $1,000 million.
Much of the money was spent on payments to men who had fought in the Union Army during the Civil War. These payments cost the government more than $100 million a year. Congress also approved millions of dollars for government projects in the home states of important congressmen. This was called pork barrel spending. It paid for new roads, bridges, and government buildings, for almost anything the congressman wanted. Congress reduced the surplus even more by approving money to build coastal defenses and to buy warships for the Navy.
The American Congress passed several historic pieces of legislation during Benjamin Harrison's administration. The Sherman Antitrust Act, the Sherman Silver Purchase Act, and the McKinley Tariff. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Shirley Griffith and Ray Freeman. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English. Thank you.